This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest.
Coming up, a political scene that is very tense. With EU membership in its pocket and with pressure from Brussels subsiding, Romania is at a critical moment. Draft dodging Russian style. Service in the military always carries the risk of dying in battle, but recruits in the Russian army face an additional risk. It may be well known that Finland has a Swedish-speaking minority, but so does another nearby nation, Estonia. And the Czechs mark the 15th anniversary of connecting to the internet. Those stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. At the helm in Stockholm this week, I'm Juan Navis. Thanks for joining the program. Coming up, draft dodging Russian style. But first, the Romanian political scene is very tense. With EU membership in its pocket and with pressure from Brussels subsiding, Romania is at a critical moment. Iulian Muresan reports.
Much has happened in the last few weeks on the Romanian political scene. The ruling coalition, made up of the National Liberal Party and the Democratic Party, which won the elections in 2004, no longer works. Liberal Prime Minister Călin Popescu-Tăriceanu is at open war with the President of Romania, Traian Băsescu. Things seem to be spiraling out of control. The President, who is the most popular politician in Romania, is the subject of an impeachment procedure supported by the opposition and his former liberal allies. One of the best foreign ministers Romania has ever had, Mihai Răzvan Ungureanu, fell victim to the conflict between the Prime Minister and the President. The Romanians watched the circus helplessly.
On behalf of the government, as Prime Minister, I feel bound to say that Romania has priorities resulting from our new EU membership, and we have to fulfill our obligations. Our interest is to fully benefit from EU membership, but all this while we have been drawn into political games which are useless to the citizen.
Such a statement by Prime Minister Călin Popescu-Tăriceanu does very little for Romania's post-accession strategy, which is gracefully non-existent. The main preoccupation for Romanian politicians is how to better position themselves to get hold of European money. President Traian Băsescu has repeatedly warned against this.
There is the possibility that only a few people will benefit from Romania's EU integration. The economic figures, like the GDP and the growth rate, may look good, but the result may be an extreme polarization of the Romanian society between the very few rich, who will continue to take advantage of EU integration, and the poor majority, who will continue to be poor.
In late December 2006, President Băsescu appeared before Parliament and condemned communism. The statement acted like a religious exorcism. The reaction was so violent that the only conclusion would be that there are still plenty of communists in Romania's parliament. Then the president accused politicians of passing legislation for criminal groups of interests around them. The result? The entire political class, with the exception of the Democratic Party, rallied to impeach the president.
Surely there is nervousness among our politicians because calling the prosecutor on the phone no longer works. In the last 2 years, the former and present local barons, former and present ministers, parliamentarians, local councillors have started to answer before the law. I would say that justice has started working, which creates a great discomfort to those who have entered politics only to get rich.
Justice has given very faint signals that it's started working, and all that thanks to the efforts made by Minister of Justice, Monica Macovei, to reform the judiciary and combat corruption. We can say we owe EU membership to her, but now many feel threatened, so that the opposition tabled a simple motion against her, which passed the Senate. She's under a lot of pressure, and she's pretty much alone in her fight. It's clear that the Romanians want to move forward, but the majority of the Romanian political class are defying a whole nation, preoccupied exclusively by their own interests. The people are not disappointed, they are angry.
It's a fact of life and death. Service in the military always carries the risk of dying in battle. But recruits in the Russian army face an additional risk. They stand a chance of dying at the hands of older conscripts. Abusive treatment of army recruits in Russia is widespread, with hazing blamed for hundreds of suicides and thousands of desertions each year. From Moscow, Charles Maines offers this look at draft dodging Russian style.
Valentina Melnikova has just arrived at her office, and the news is not what she was hoping for. Melnikova heads the Committee of Soldiers' Mothers. The group monitors the Russian military for incidents of mistreatment of its own soldiers. Melnikova has been tracking a case that involves a soldier who deserted his unit and then went missing. She says the soldier's mother fears her son may have become the latest victim of his own army.
The military official for a long time kept denying it, saying no, no, no. And now finally he's called the mother and told her they found a body hung from a tree in the forest somewhere. Is it him? Not him? Is he alive? Nobody knows. Of course, that weighs heavy on the mind.
The official account is the army returned the young man to his unit, and then he ran away again. Melnikova says she and other members of her committee just don't know what to believe.
We were hoping he might turn up while it was still warm, but now? Unfortunately, this happens hundreds of times a year. We found that often there's a faked suicide, but no one believes it, and no one investigates.
It's stories like these that have stamped Russia's army with a reputation for lawlessness and brutality. A 2004 report by Human Rights Watch documented routine abuse of conscripts. Russian law requires all young men between 18 and 27 to serve 2 years in the army. But on this recent evening in Moscow, about 80 potential draftees have given 2 hours to listen to Melnikova explain how to avoid conscription. Now, Melnikova is a trained lawyer, so it's a bit odd to see her dispensing medical advice. That slip on the ice when you were little. Did you hit your head? One leg is clearly shorter than the other. Take him in for a cardiogram. Avoiding conscription takes preparation. Education and medical deferments are available, but they take official stamps, forms, and more forms. Many prefer to simplify their luck with bribes. But Melnikova warns the audience that paying money guarantees nothing. Still, many here say they're at least willing to consider going the bribe route.
One guy I know bought his way out of service by bringing money to the recruiting office. I think it was about $4,000. He was supposed to be conscripted, but he didn't have to go.
A bribe gets it done a little faster. You pay a bribe and he's obligated to help. So if you can't get it done legally, pay the money and it gets done. That's my opinion.
I would think about that if it came to it. I have a lot of friends gone that route. With the money you can earn in 2 years in Moscow, it pays for itself.
According to Russian government statistics, just 9% of eligible young men are ultimately drafted for service each year. But many Russian families are unwilling to risk even those odds. It depends, they point out, on which percentile is yours. Young men here, however, say they would serve if the army had something to offer. As is, they see the military as 2 years deleted from their lives. That's also the view of parents like Larissa, who's come to the meeting to learn how to keep her son out of the Russian army.
If it was the Soviet army, the one that used to exist, I wouldn't fight for him not to go. I think every mother would let their son go. But now there are no rules, none at all. They can't even guarantee that he'll return alive or unharmed.
The case of Private Andrei Sychov still reverberates in this country. Sychov was serving in the city of Chelyabinsk when he was beaten and tortured by higher-ups last New Year's Eve. He contracted gangrene after delays in medical treatment, resulting in the amputation of his legs and genitals. The horror of the incident made national headlines here, but only, says activist Valentina Melnikova, after the authorities attempted to suppress the story.
Им запретили что-то показывать, что-то печатать. И мы подняли шум.
They tried to prevent the press from writing about it. But we made a lot of noise, and the message got out, thanks to the Internet, thanks to Bill Gates.
Добрый день, уважаемые товарищи. Наше традиционное совещание посвящено подведению итогов...
Technology was also on the mind of Russian President Vladimir Putin during his annual address at the Defense Ministry in Moscow in December. In the speech, Putin detailed plans to upgrade weaponry and modernize Russia's strategic forces. Those steps will include a push towards a professional contract army, with just 1 year of mandatory service for Russian conscripts by 2008.
Учитывая предстоящее сокращение срока службы,
Putin said the move was designed to avoid tearing conscripts away for too long from their regular lives. But it may take more than words to convince young Russians that with army service comes security, not only for the nation, but the soldiers themselves. Charles Maines, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
You're listening to Network Europe. Be sure to stay tuned because later on in the program we'll be announcing the winners of this month's Network Europe quiz. But before that, according to a recently published government report, Polish military intelligence, which was disbanded last year, was involved in illegal activities and exerted illegitimate influence on Polish public life after the fall of communism. Polish Radio's Joanna Nudgefeld reports.
Polish military secret services, or the WSI that operated in Poland after the fall of communism, largely exceeded their legal objectives and were involved in a number of criminal irregularities, states the long-awaited government report on the activity of the now-resolved Polish military secret services. The communist-rooted military intelligence did not fulfill its regular counterintelligence duties properly, was involved in economic crime and weapon trading on a large scale, exerted illegitimate influence on media and politics in democratic Poland, concludes the report. Journalist Krzysztof Leski.
This report clearly proves that the WSI, frankly speaking, went wild after overthrow of communism in Poland in 1989. And it's not about individual agents. This seems to be the truth about the entire service, which roughly acted as a state within a state, with one clear objective, to make money in illegal transactions.
One of the striking revelations of the report is also the involvement of Polish military intelligence with the Russian secret services, with some Polish WSI officers having been trained in the Soviet Union. Reportedly, the WSI were also suspiciously lenient towards the activity of Russian intelligence in Poland. The publication of the report is an element of the current Polish government's policy of clearing the public life of dangerous entanglements with the past, Defense Minister Aleksander Szczygło.
This is supposed to be a warning for all those who think that military services or secret services in general are allowed to influence a democratic state. They may do that, but only in order to protect democracy and not destroy it.
According to the commission that authored the report, over 2,500 agents of the military secret services infiltrated Polish public life in the 1990s, following the collapse of communism. In a press conference following the publication of the report, Polish President Lech Kaczyński stressed the clues pointing to military intelligence tampering with the public opinion through the media.
Placing an agent as a program director of a very influential TV station, or as the deputy head of another also important TV station, or placing someone as a deputy director of the Television Information Agency, or the spokesman of public TV are, I think, very effective ways to influence the media message.
The report mentions names of public officials and journalists whose secret cooperation with the military intelligence was in breach of the law. Among those mentioned as responsible for irregularities in this area were Poland's former presidents, famous Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa, and the post-communist Aleksander Kwaśniewski. The report caused uproar and heated discussion, with many of the accused saying they will sue the report authors for libel. Opposition Civic Platform party leader Donald Tusk, though critical of the government's handling of the whole problem, would like to see the people mentioned in the report put on trial. Publishing a report is not enough, he says.
I want something much more severe. I would like all the perpetrators mentioned in this report to answer for their deeds before court.
Many of the accused deny the charges. General Marek Dukhachevsky, former head of the military intelligence, says he was unaware of the alleged criminal irregularities.
No important documents were destroyed in order to hide traces of any illegal operations. I don't know of any such cases, and for sure, while I was in charge, no such situation took place.
According to opinion journalist Jerzy Jachowicz of the Dziennik Daily, the report comes years too late.
We wouldn't have those cancerous tumours on the military intelligence, about which we will never know the whole truth, now that many documents have been destroyed. Also, many things were not documented at all, probably also about their involvement with some of the media. If all that had been dealt with 15 years ago, we would have a different situation now.
Report authors say the document is incomplete and will be amended many times before it reaches its final shape. More names and facts on WSI irregularities are expected to surface.
You're listening to Network Europe. Still to come, the phenomena of opinion polls in French newspapers and magazines. But first, it's time to announce the winners of this month's Network Europe quiz. The question was, what is the name of the festival held in Italy for couples in conjunction with St. Valentine's Day? The answer was, of course, in our special program to mark Valentine's Day, and the correct answer is Festa della Promessa. Now, we put all the correct answers in a barrel and chose three. So, the lucky winners are Mr. Riaz Hussein in Pakistan, Steve Bauer of Culver City, California, USA, and Debbie Mill in Chesapeake, Virginia, USA. There is a little something from Network Europe on the way in the post to you. Thanks to all those that wrote in to us, and you can look forward to the next quiz in March. The French presidential elections are 2 months away, but newspapers and magazines are already trying to say who will win. Opinion polls abound, almost one a day, pitting the frontrunners Nicolas Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal against others who are not even on the ballot yet. The official list of candidates won't be firmed up until the end of March. Sarah Elzas looks at the phenomena of opinion polls that appear constantly on the front pages of French newspapers and magazines.
Voilà, là nous publions donc un sondage qui montre que Ségolène Royal remonte à la fois pour le premier tour.
Thierry Borsa is an editor at Le Parisien, a daily French paper that's been publishing voter intention results regularly for the past several months. He leafs through Wednesday's paper, which has a survey on the top of the front page, showing Ségolène Royal 4 points higher than Nicolas Sarkozy in the first round of the election.
Alors que dans les dernières études, Nicolas Sarkozy était aux alentours de 55% et Ségolène Royal autour de 45%.
Borsa explains that Sarkozy was polling at 55% and Royal at 44%. Now the results are different. This, of course, with 30% of respondents who are undecided. Polls are everywhere, but they haven't proven very accurate in the past. In 1995, survey results favored Prime Minister Edouard Balladur, yet he was beat out by Lionel Jospin, who then lost to his challenger Jacques Chirac. In 2002, the same thing. No polls predicted that the right-wing Jean-Marie Le Pen would enter the second round of voting, but he did, pushing out Jospin. Despite their inaccuracies, politicians and journalists continue to commission and use opinion polls.
There is in France, like in any other country, a controversy about the use newspapers can make of the figures in order to influence the voters, the one to be the first to publish a new results.
Mathieu Douaré is the survey manager at CSA, a polling institute that's regularly commissioned by Le Parisien to conduct voting intention polls. Douaré explains that he looks for trends. These days, the trend is Ségolène Royal losing points.
And the opposite trend was the increase in voting intentions for François Bayrou on the same period.
François Bayrou, a center-right candidate, has been making headlines, polling recently around 15%. Douaré is quick to point out that the surveys are not predictions, but it's always good when they're right.
We learn a lot from our mistakes and try to make the best of what we already knew about the people's opinion.
Jean Chiche studies public opinion and surveys at Sciences Politiques. He says voters decide in the last days of an election. If you look at the numbers from a week before the 2002 election, it was obvious that Jospin was going down. The numbers were there, but people weren't looking.
There would have to be imaginative analysis that transcended political analysis. Very few people did that. But that doesn't mean that the trends are false. They are real. They are correct.
Chiche doesn't discredit all surveys. In fact, his own organization, the CEVIPOF, produces a political barometer of French politics, which he says digs deep into the issues concerning the French electorate. He dismisses the more basic surveys based on small sample sizes, like the ones conducted by CSA for Le Parisien.
What we see daily in newspapers are surveys based on 800 to 1,000 people, which gives us margins of error that vary between 3.1 and 5%. So if we say this candidate goes up by 1, goes down by 2, or by 3 points, it has absolutely no statistical importance.
The numbers may not have statistical value, but they sell newspapers, at least according to the woman who sells papers in the kiosk outside of the CSA offices in Paris.
S'il y a des sondages en ce moment, surtout la politique, donc ça se vend plus.
She explains that she doesn't pay much attention to the surveys herself, but it sells papers, so she doesn't mind.
Mais ça vend les journaux, donc ça m'arrange.
Les sondages qui nous intéressent le plus sont ceux qui montrent une évolution.
Mathieu Borsa, editor of Le Parisien.
The polls that constantly reproduce the same numbers and that show that the situation is stable are journalistically not very interesting, and for our readers it's not as interesting as a survey that shows that things are changing. But we are not looking for movement everywhere. We are not telling them what to say to the pollsters. We are just here to explain the evolution to our readers, if there is evolution.
So the papers want change, because that makes the news. But do the numbers actually influence voters? No, says Jean
Chiche.
I don't think that surveys have any influence on electoral choices, no more than an editorial from a political commentator. A survey is an element of information among others. It provides a kind of background noise. I don't think they have an influence on the outcome of the vote. It's a tool like any other.
It may be fairly well known that the Swedish language thrives in neighboring country Finland, where more than 5% of the population speaks it as their mother tongue. But while they are really only a linguistic minority, efforts are being stepped up to recognize people with Swedish background in another nearby nation, Estonia. It too has a long common history with Sweden, and now a cultural council's been set up there to make full use of the Estonian Swedes' cultural autonomy rights. Tom McAlinden has more.
Swede Sofia Junes, with her music influenced by the Estonian-Swedish minority, which have lived in the coastal areas of the small Baltic state for hundreds of years. But like thousands of other Estonian Swedes, her family fled to Sweden during the Second World War, when Estonia was forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union. Life for those who stayed in Estonia took a turn for the worse. Islands many lived on became military bases, their homes were seized, their farms were ruined, and contact with their relatives in Sweden was severed. Lars Runbe from the Estonian Swedes Association in Sweden says before then their culture was pretty strong and visible.
There were Swedish schools, we had our own newspaper, there were certain parts of Estonia, some of the islands, which were more or less only Swedish speaking. So there was a majority in certain areas in Estonia. And with a population of about 10,000 Swedes, it was one of the larger minorities in Estonia.
Between 1918 and 1940, Estonian Swedes enjoyed several special rights as a minority, such as education in their native tongue, the ability to use it in official procedures, and they were allowed to form institutions to help protect these rights. Unlike the Germans or Jews, though, they didn't make full use of the cultural autonomy rights granted in 1925. They didn't think they needed to. until now. This week, the Estonian-Swedish Council meets for the first time. I asked member Ulla-Kaak Remes why it's needed.
Many Estonian Swedes are trying to take back the language, to take back their culture. They want to go on and they get the possibilities they had before the war. But because they are not so many in Estonian today, this is the best way to go on in the quite different situation. Perhaps many are interested in small industry to go back and really work and live and to get the old Estonian Swedes known as a group who is really living and going on for the future.
But what makes the Estonian Swedes so unique anyway? I asked Lars Rundberg why they're neither one nationality nor the other.
There are Swedes in Finland, there are Swedes in Sweden, and there are Swedes in Estonia. And the Swedes in Estonia were fairly isolated, so the language and the culture has preserved much of what it was from several hundred years ago.
So they're the true Swedes?
More or less the true Swedes, yes.
The Cultural Council's got the full backing of the Estonian government, which has also given Estonian Swedes in Sweden the right to be on it too. But why is the government so concerned about such a tiny minority? I asked its representative in Sweden, Ambassador Alice Strayman.
If we speak the numbers, then before the war it was about approximately 10,000 people who identified themselves as being part of the Estonian Swedes. Almost, if I'm not mistaken, almost 9,000 fled to Sweden. So only a few thousand, 1,000, a little bit more, stayed behind. Now many have moved back, not too many, but they keep their relations. They keep summer times, they have their relatives. I would say that we are positively concerned. So we are not negatively concerned as regards the Estonian government, because it enriches every society. I mean, every small minority is today, in my opinion, is a wealth for a country.
How visible is this minority group in Estonia?
Quite visible. Not maybe everywhere, but especially on the west coast and the small islands, which have been traditionally inhabited by the people. But I hope that now that they have become more organized, that it will become more visible, but not only in Estonia, but also in Sweden. I think it's very important to keep this link between Sweden and Estonia, but not too visible, unfortunately. Could be much, much more.
Do they need to be protected?
That's a good question. Well, the protection is not maybe the right word for what these people need. In today's world, when people so often are only concerned about the work and the income and the mass culture, I think it's very important that people have their own ideas and then they promote them, and that's an important combination.
Is this part of efforts to reaffirm the Estonian identity as it was before the Second World War?
As far as it goes to really putting things right in the historical perspective, I think it's important to do this, because these people mostly were forced to flee from their homes. Whether they want to substantively move back today or whether they don't, that's not really so important. But they should have a feeling that it has been their home, and it still is, if they wish it to be so. That Estonia considers them to be part of the Estonian community. It has been their home and still is, if they so wish. And if they want to promote their history, their roots, then they can do it now.
The internet is such a huge part of our lives, it's hard to imagine a time before it existed. But it is, of course, relatively new. In Prague this month, they are marking the 15th anniversary of the day the Czechs officially hooked up to the net. Few would have imagined in 1992 just how big a step they were taking. The man who connected the then Czechoslovakia to the web was Jan Gruntorad. He spoke to Radio Prague's Dita Asidor.
By that time, of course, there was no graphical information. It was just the plain text. Actually, there was no web, there were no other advanced services, so email was the most used service. And what was very new and very advanced, that we can, for example, telnet, that means login to computer in the university in Linz, and see some of the files that are available. Of course, for us, it was very valuable, because before political changes, it was very difficult to communicate with our colleagues, as we call in the West. But these computer networks bring very new features that we can communicate with them using electronic means. Before that, only the classical mail was available. For example, you send a letter to your colleagues, and it was about 1 to 2 weeks to deliver the letter, so you can have a reply from your colleagues in about 1 month's time.
Do you still have some of the old technology from that time?
Yes, I do, actually. This room, that is the first multi-protocol router over there, that's preserve. And over there, there is old telecommunication panel when the line from Linz was terminated. So I am planning to have some internet museum, but I'm planning to do it at some, let's say, 20th anniversary or something like that.
So what was the reaction of the media and of the people?
Well, frankly speaking, media were not interesting about that at all, because they actually didn't know what is and what's phenomenon. And so even some, let's say, people from the field by the time didn't think that the internet is the right way. Even we invited the press to that even, but nobody attended.
Well, how did you feel then, knowing that this has happened and the rest of the country doesn't really care and doesn't know?
You know, frankly speaking, by that time we didn't see, let's say, the future that in, let's say, 15 years, everybody will have nearly a PC connected to the network. PC were coming, but rather slowly. The first PC was about 180,000 Czech crowns. And if you imagine, the average salary by that time was about 2,000 Czech crowns. So it was something, again, difficult to imagine that every, let's say, home will have a PC. So for us, it was really a dream.
How long did it take for ordinary residents to actually be able to connect to the internet?
I would say even it was more difficult. First, for example, 1 year, only people in Prague in the premises of Czech Technical University can connect. Then we built the CESnet network in about 92, 93, and that connect only universities. And connection of ordinary people started to happen, let's say, while dial-up modem in the 94, 95, for example. We were told we need a license for charging people for using internet, but Czech telecommunication office told us we have no mechanism how to issue license for the internet, because it was very new. So it took us about 1 year to solve these legal problems. And my experience is that usually technical problems are easier to solve than the legal and economic problems, because to working with the ministries is usually quite, let's say, difficult times in many cases.
That just about brings us to the end of this edition of Network Europe. As always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can do so by logging on to our website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll also find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. We love to get feedback on our programs from our listeners. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas, and criticisms to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's all the time we have for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Polish Radio's External Service, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Bulgaria, and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back again next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Juan Navis in Stockholm. Thanks for joining us. Without a clue, and you wonder why.
melody. Sing out loud.